Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yuyun Zhan, host of our monthly podcast, Zhonghua Mundus, that brings you recent updates about China's economy. As usual, I am with our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia Herrero. Hi, Alicia. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, Yuyun.
We're also glad to host today Philippe Lecoq, senior fellow at the Asia Society Policy Institute's Center for China Analysis, senior advisor on geopolitics to Asia Society France. He's also a professor at ASEC Business School. Nice to meet you, Philippe, and welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Thank you very much, Yuyun. I'm glad to be there and with you and Alicia.
Thank you for joining us today. The first China shock came after the country's accession to the World Trade Organization in 2001, where it reshaped trade flows, labor markets, and industrial capacity across the world. Now there's talk of a second one. Alicia, what is China Shock 2.0, and why is it dominating conversations in Brussels right now?
Let me tell you that before I even explain what China Shock 2.0 is, I just came back from Shanghai and I just learned about China's shock 3.0. What I'm trying to say here is that whoever thinks this is like a temporary shock and, you know, forget it. And that is very important to understand what it is. It is basically China's massive both upgrade of its industry beyond its industry. The 3.0 I was referring to will go into services, digital services. You know, so we're now in the industrial 2.0, but that is extended to many more products than the 1.0 used to be, where it was mostly cement, steel, you know, like heavy industrial products. Now we're into chemicals, we're into the so-called new production forces, basically green tech. We are even into pharmaceuticals, APIs, I mean, you name it. It's a very, very extended definition of manufacturing power. Why is it happening? Because China is certainly very innovative and more productive in certain sectors, but also, and the OECD has amazingly shocking figures on how many subsidies China is putting on the table to get there. So it's a combination of subsidies, decreasing prices, which makes China very competitive, a stubbornly depreciated exchange rate, and of course, the good news, innovation, productivity. But that's only part of the story. So because of that, China is gaining market share globally. Europe is by no means the largest exporter in the world anymore, although it was for decades. And that changed right after COVID. So since COVID, China is the largest exporter in the world, and Europe has 360 billion trade deficit with China. Most people say, who cares about the bilateral trade deficit? Then I would say, focus on the global trade share, which we have lost. Why are we losing it? Because China is more competitive, both because of being more innovative, but also because of this deflationary and subsidy kind of environment. So that's the summary of the China shock.
The EU is also responding to this China shock 2.0. The response has centered on a new set of autonomous trade instruments, including something called the overcapacity instrument. Alicia, could you walk us through what that actually is and what it's designed to do?
Well, I'll be brief because this is really in the making. We could see a lot of changes, so I'm going to just be very, very kind of general here. And that generalization actually starts before the instruments that you just referred to. So Europe has been working on a series of trade defense measures for years. Yeah, this is not new. Some of which looked really relevant and strong, like the ACI, the anti-coercion instrument, or even the foreign subsidy legislation. Some of those legislations didn't ever go through, like we had one on the supply chain, which was simply too difficult for companies to introduce. Then we have the usual, like everybody has those instruments, WTO compliant, anti-dumping, anti-subsidy investigations, which we have used. So I would say we've mainly used the old instruments. We've not used the new instruments. Now, there you go, we want even more instruments, yeah, the Industrial Accelerator Act, the others you mentioned on the overcapacity or cybersecurity instrument. But frankly speaking, if you think about it, why haven't we used the old ones? Yeah. So my question here, and we'll hear from Philip, is we are accumulating toolkits, but it seems maybe we're not ready to use either the old or the new, that maybe we will not even pass the new, you know, like based on experience in the past, not everything we programmed was actually legislated. So in that regard, yes, we're trying to show our muscle, but I don't think our muscle is so visible as we may think. And again, it is really a very dynamic muscling process that we are into at the moment.
And Philip, would you like to add on to Alicia's response here?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there was this non-paper that was launched by several countries, France, Italy, Spain, the Netherlands, and Lithuania. This was interesting because the previous action by several EU member states took place about 10 years before, and Alicia was referring to instruments, but that's led to the screening mechanism, or at least the sort of common mechanism at EU level, a non-binding agreement for screening. And that was launched originally by a letter by three members. I think that was France, Italy, and Germany, if I recall correctly. This led to a new attitude, maybe, at EU level, and having a screening mechanism, even non-binding, and pushing member states into adopting their own national screening mechanism. Now, that also led to, you know, the famous triptych and how to deal with China. But I think now, as Alicia was just saying, we've reached a different dimension. And we're now talking about a very tougher instruments, using investigations, using a more proactive, you know, economic security criteria and to deal with imbalances. This is also what is surrounding the IAA, the Industrial Accelerator Act, which puts strict conditions on investments into the Union from China or other countries, for that matter. It doesn't specify China. This is what the EU is about, not naming the name. But that is really going in the right direction, even though there are so many difficulties. For example, the new non-paper that we're talking about included Spain, but Spain seemed to have withdrawn from it. Alicia can tell us more about it. So the China Shock 2.0 means that at least the EU is discussing China on the right topic and at the right level.
Yeah, indeed, you mentioned this non-paper, and that also kind of shows the members' fragmentation because not all countries joined it. Spain has distanced itself, and Germany is even more cautious, being mindful of its own exports. So is member states' fragmentation the biggest obstacle here when it comes to, you know, EU policymaking, even bigger than China itself?
You know, Germany has been part of the problem for a very long time. Germany is the EU's biggest economy and exporting power. But from the 1980s, I don't want to go back to too many decades, but this is, you know, that tells volumes about my age probably and how long I've been traveling to China. But from the 80s onwards, you know, German brands became household names in Chinese factories. Anybody who's visited Chinese factories know that German machine tools were spreading like mushrooms, you know, and all these German brands were highly respected. But at the same time, German factories started to spread in China as well through investments. But since 2010, of course, we've started seeing a reverse phenomenon. German companies, Mittelstand in particular, being taken over by Chinese enterprises, and the market share of these German companies being somewhat reduced, which means that Germany has a very different take into all this compared to many other countries. Maybe France would be one of the countries that has a long tradition of dealing with China from the start of the open door policy, or even before that, when you think about 60 plus years of diplomatic relations between the PRC and the French Republic. But as Alicia said, I mean, we now have this situation of this overall trade deficit with China for the EU, which stands at 360 billion in 2025 and counting. And Germany's own deficit stands at 90 billion euro. So I find Germany's attitude, it's understandable, but it's quite extraordinary how much time it's taking to decide one way or the other. For example, 10 years ago, if you walked into the German Ministry of Economics, there was no China desk. You would struggle to meet somebody who knew much about China, who was not just supporting companies to invest or to do business with China. Now, of course, it's changed, but there's a lack of political willingness to push for these tougher measures. And of course, France, which has been hosting the G7 recently, is taking a different stance, and others are more or less sitting in the middle. All this in a transatlantic context, which is, of course, making things difficult.
Alicia, Philip has also mentioned the members' fragmentation. Is unity structurally impossible, given how differently exposed member states are? For example, like Philip mentioned, Germany and France are in very different positions economically. Is there a policy that would work for both?
Maybe we don't need policies to work for everybody. We just need rules to be tough enough for member states not to undermine the EU level benefit. So in other words, for me, the question is not whether there is something that fits everybody. The question really is whether we have an institutional framework in the EU that makes it costly for countries to benefit from free riding. That, for me, is the key question, because there will never be. I mean, this is true even at, if you ask me, think about China. Yeah, maybe some policies benefit Guangdong and others do not, but Guangdong cannot come and say, I do not agree with this. So that's obviously Europe is not China, but that's what I'm trying to say here. So the question really is whether we should not reflect on how to make our trade and investment policies less dependent on member states' decisions. So let me give you one example. And this is a normative statement I want to make for this podcast. For everything that is still, you know, fully WTO related, such as anti-dumping investigation or anti-subsidy investigations, which lead to tariffs. This is electric vehicle tariffs, for example. We need qualified majority to stop the Commission's decision. And this is why we managed to impose these tariffs, because Germany, which voted against, to Philip's point, could not basically on its own and a few small countries bypass the Commission's decision. However, now with the Industrial Accelerator Act to approve this new protection instrument, if you want to call it that way, or defensive instrument, we need qualified majority to approve it. It's very different, yeah? I mean, now if you just have, which is likely, Spain and Germany against, you're going to find it very difficult to have qualified majority to pass this new legislation. So why? I'm wondering, this is basically a trade and investment tool. I wonder whether we could go back to the Commission has the leeway, and only if a qualified majority disagrees, this new tool does not go through. The same applies to the anti-cohesion instrument, where you need qualified majority to put it to work. So, you know, again, who is going to manage to convince a qualified majority of member states to put it in action? So that shouldn't be. It should be the other way around. The Commission should have the leeway, the possibility to use these instruments, let alone to enact them in the case of the Industrial Accelerator Act. So, you know, this is not about the treaty. This is about us. We should let the Commission work. If the Commission thinks we have a problem, well, then the Commission should go ahead, and only if it is very clear that this is a big mistake, i.e. qualified majority, then only then you should stop the commission. That's not how we work today.
My understanding is that the commission is going through not really a crisis, but some restructuring, some new directions, also due to this China shock or steamroller, as a report called it, because everything is accelerating. And of course, we live in a very geopolitical sensitive environment. And for example, the European External Action Service is, you know, we're talking about making changes in it. And the Trade Directorate has a new Director General. But overall, what is really lacking is the political will. So I agree with you, Alicia, on the majority issue in the EU. We need to rethink the way the EU is functioning. The EU is not there to please anybody, and the European Commission is there to implement a political will. And I think the political will is there. When you hear everyone, including the German Chancellor, you know, the trade situation is such that the EU cannot just stand still. Otherwise, we will have nothing left. As I think the Italian business minister said, you know, if the IA can't enter into force in 3 years, there won't be anything left to protect by then.
Yeah, time is really of essence here. Philip, how is Beijing reading all of this? And how is it responding to Europe's actions?
So China, of course, is not going to stand still. They cancelled high-level meetings with EU counterparts. The Trade Commissioner, Sefcovic, of course, is in a difficult situation. When you hear him in interviews and meetings, he's being extremely cautious because he wants to continue this dialogue. China, of course, as we know, has been the champion of divide and rule with the EU, which sometimes doesn't actually need outsiders to push for this. But I think the real problem is China threatening to retaliate if the EU was to impose trade restrictions. So, for example, at the end of May, the Chinese Ministry of Commerce openly said they would take resolute countermeasures and effective steps to safeguard Chinese interests. So that is really a kind of a weaponization of compliance. You know, we've seen what China is able to do when it comes to critical minerals vis-a-vis the United States. And, you know, what happened recently in this US-China summit in Beijing showed that this is no longer on the table, but it could come back. You know, the US and China are talking, you know, on a number of trade issues. But we know that China has the edge on when it comes to critical minerals. And this is something that the Europeans should feel concerned about. So it's difficult for the EU to have a conversation with China, which probably feels a bit overconfident about all this, maybe, if not arrogant. I mean, I know it's very difficult when you're in Brussels to deal with Chinese officials because they really give a hard time to the European Commission people, also in China itself, the EU delegation. And they try to, you know, talk to individual member states to try to influence and to lobby, really, this is the word, to lobby the EU level, particularly the European Commission. But the European Commission is just an executive body of the EU. So they're basically doing what the European Council is deciding.
As you rightly point out, that Europe is very dependent on China for many things, like critical raw materials, components, and also chunks of its green tech supply chain. How much does that dependency actually constrain what Brussels can do? And is de-risking on those inputs even remotely achievable in a relevant timeframe?
You know, the problem is Beijing can go back to imposing tariffs and also compliance to European or Western companies via the Ministry of Commerce if trade negotiations don't go well. But at the same time, you know, the EU is going to deepen its tools. So this is really looking more and more like some kind of trade conflict, because the EU is going to ask for more licensing, and China will use rare earth inputs as a countermeasure. This is something that unfortunately is threatening to come to the table. But the question is whether we are prepared to have a discussion with the Chinese to explain that the EU economy needs to create jobs. You know, we cannot sort of stand still and wait for Chinese products to flow into the market. The other thing is on critical minerals, we need to talk to other players. The US has some ideas on this, especially on mining and extraction, while the EU is more interested perhaps in reprocessing. But on the supply chain side, we need to have discussions with like-minded countries, so to speak, including Japan, including Canada, and even the US. So it's not like Europe is totally alone on that front. But we need to be aware that China might trigger this, as they did in the past, and quite successfully in the case of the United States.
Alicia, do you want to add something here?
Yeah, I just came back from Shanghai, and I cannot agree more with Philip. China's tone is increasingly aggressive. Not even aggressive, the word is even worse than that. And it's literally the words that I've heard in Beijing. We don't really care. That's the word. And it's based on two principles, but I'm not sure whether these principles are real. That's the problem. The first principle is China needs nothing from Europe. This is kind of literally the mantra of the conversation. We produce everything you do. We do it more cheaply. There's no way you can compete. You don't have any commodities, nothing that we really need. So we are natural competitors by now. And therefore, don't expect much. You know, if you move into services or into luxury, China firmly believes that, you know, European exports, again, services, you could think of financial services, you could think of tourism, you could think of even that, and rightly so, because that's what the data shows, is waning, especially tourism. I don't know whether you know, but Philip, fasten your seatbelt. Russia receives 50% more tourists than France from China. So that's the kind of comparative advantage, supposedly, that Russia has compared to Europe. So the point is, it is quite obvious, looking at this Russia-France number for tourism, that it is not really so. It's just that it is not market-driven. I mean, that there surely could be certain things that Europe can offer. It's just that, frankly speaking, the Chinese government does not want its citizens to import those goods or services. And that trickles down into substitution of machinery. By now, actually, and this is not Europe, but the US, not even NVIDIA GPUs are basically, even H200, as you know, since the meeting, there's still this idea that why not just use Huawei's chips instead? So, you know, even the most advanced stuff, China supposedly doesn't need.
But to be honest, Alicia, on tourism, I hear what you say, but I've never been, you know, a great believer in Chinese tourism in Europe, because the actual numbers don't translate into great revenues for European economies, you know?
Of course, they don't, for the very same reason. Let me give you one example. Try to fly out of Shanghai on a European airline. Just try. You know, good luck. I've heard, and this I'm going to keep it here, maybe some of our listeners will know more, but I heard from a good source, that was Beijing actually, that our airlines receive some kind of compensation for not traveling. If you hear what I'm saying, the degree of non-market forces that are confirming, quote-unquote, that narrative that China doesn't need anything from us. I'd rather fly in, you know, a European airline than what I did when I was in Beijing going to Brussels. But, you know, I couldn't, because there was no single way for me to avoid it. So that's one principle. We don't need anything from you. I'm arguing maybe in a market economy you might, but yes, in the current circumstances, you don't. The second argument is, no matter whether you believe whether we need you or not, never mind, because if you impose protectionist measures, we will, and this is the word that is used, obliterate you. So, you know, on that basis, I think there is not much Europe can do. So this is not only about member states, as you said, you know, trying to find free riding. No, it's really about this threat being real, because China has a lot of choke points that it can impose on us. Do we have choke points to fight back? All of our choke points are national level choke points for obvious reasons. ASML, maybe some people even talk about SAP. All of these choke points are not EU level because of the way Europe works. And therefore, we actually do not really have. We could have a few if you push the accelerator to a very strict outbound investment screening. I can only tell you the Shanghai municipality is desperate to receive more investment from Europe. Totally. Because actually, overall, not only European, but European investment has fallen still 10%. Inward FDI from Europe, and actually overall FDI has fallen even more. So Europeans are actually better in terms of the slowdown of FDI into China is stronger for the rest of the world than it is for Europe. So, you know, this is important because this is job creation. China is really very, very worried about the impact of AI and especially automation into the workforce. So anything that is less investment into China is a worry. But can we use those choke points? Maybe not.
But the question is, can Shanghai really decide much with the central government that is really setting the point?
No, of course. I'm not saying Shanghai would change anything. What I'm saying is that China generally, and certainly those provinces with more inward FDI, would love to see that continue. So we could use it as a choke point, but we can't because we don't even have an outbound investment screening in place. Yeah, we do not have that instrument yet. We only have an inbound investment screening. And even if we did, it would have to be draconian, meaning not just a coordination committee like we have for the inbound. It would have to be literally approved or not by, say, the commission, and with, again, only qualified majority to stop the commission's decision. You see, so we don't have the choke points because we've not designed instruments to have them. The same thing with export controls, Philip. We don't have a coordinated export control mechanism. It's still country level. So for all of those reasons, the US can come and tell the Netherlands, you know, do not export whatever type of advanced lithography machine from ASML, but we cannot do that because we don't have the instrument. So, you know, again, if everything we need an instrument, we need qualified majority, we're stuck. So it is, in a way, the fact we don't have any retaliation power is true, not only because the relation is very asymmetric, I get it, it's also because we don't have the instruments. So that part, we should blame ourselves for that one. I mean, that's for me very clear.
Well, it's also our ADN. You know, we are 27 countries around the table. We know how complicated it is. The EU has enlarged itself over the past 20 years. And the more players, the more difficulties, even though, of course, we know that what matters most in a way is the, you know, of course, Germany's stand because of its weight, and France, the Netherlands, you mentioned, and perhaps Italy and Spain. These would be the largest players, maybe Poland. At the same time, we need this common approach. And I find, I mean, I've been looking at this for many years now, like you, and I find the EU's more and more on a collision course with the PRC, while individual states, and there's the example of not just Germany, but also Spain, are trying to, if they are thrown out of the door, they're trying to come back through the window. And certainly Spain's policy has been quite special, to say the least, over the past few years under the current Spanish government.
Yeah, like you mentioned, there's no painless path to solve this problem. The EU will have to absorb real short-term costs to protect its industrial base. So who will actually bear that pain? Would it be workers in specific sectors, consumers through higher prices, or particular member states?
I think before we answer that question, I've heard the Spanish government twice already, and I know Philip wants to hear my view, so let me go for it very quickly. I've written it so many times in the Spanish media. Spain has very little to benefit from having this skewed position on China for a very simple reason. We're not big exporters into China. We're not big investors into China. And the investment we are receiving into basically EVs and batteries is itself quite asymmetric. More to come. I already warned you of a one coming and in Galicia with a very interesting, which I'm not going to unveil now. But what I'm saying is this is mostly little money, lots of subsidies, potentially not many jobs, and sometimes with critical infrastructure consequences. I leave it there. So you don't need to convince me, Philip. I'm fully convinced on this one. So I, for the record, I just want to answer your question. But now moving to, again, trying to make this podcast as normative as possible. I think it is unavoidable. This is not only Spain. This is literally every country, including Germany, asking for big investments from China. So, you know, even the richest member states are playing the same game, if you see what I mean. We may focus on Spain, but actually it's not only Spain. I wish. It is a generalized problem. And that's why it's so important to move our investment screening to fully to the EU level. So these are my recommendations. EU screening to the EU level. I know there is a meeting of the transportation ministers with the commission to really close the door to Chinese investment into critical infrastructure, ports in particular. I hope that happens as soon as possible. Okay. Secondly, we need to avoid this qualified majority to approve any of these new instruments or we'll never do. Yeah. And we need to avoid qualified majority to put our existing instruments like the ACI in place. Because otherwise, why did we create them on the first place? Yeah. So, you know, all of these things are doable. So I hope the European Council or, you know, I know maybe this will have happened when we publish our podcast. But again, Philip and I are trying to make here a more general point that we need to have a set of instruments that is credible so that we increase our leverage, so that we can negotiate. This is not about going to war, trade war, obviously, only. We can't follow the footsteps of the US on this one, so thanks God only trade war, but we do not want a trade war. What we want is to have enough leverage to avoid the trade war and be able to negotiate with China. That's, I think, what we're trying to discuss here.
Well, exactly. I mean, in China, as we know, the market has been far from open to European companies. If we're going to have a tough discussion with China, and I think the EU officials are prepared to go for a tough ride, and Yuyun, you were asking about who's going to suffer. Well, we know that European workers are already suffering. 143,000 industrial jobs lost in Germany in 2025 and counting. I think it's 10,000 jobs that have been lost every month in Germany, and it's happening in the rest of the world as well. So I do agree that we're in for a tough ride. The EU should use its existing trade defense tools more forcefully. Otherwise, the credibility of the EU is at stake. And our partners or the countries that are dealing with the EU, and I'm not only talking about China, but also about the US and others, they will probably not take the EU seriously, and we will keep hearing about, you know, the EU being alone and not having the right tools. But of course, that also means we need to have an industrial policy, and this is also what was recommended by Mario Draghi and by Enrico Letta, and you know, all these reports that came out over the past few years. Certainly on the tech side, I mentioned earlier critical minerals, but that's of course a very tricky one for Europe since we don't have much of it, but we have a lot of partners, right? We can certainly discuss with like-minded countries on semiconductors to enlarge our supply chains.
Let's end with a simple but hard question. Best case, worst case scenario. Where do EU-China relations go from here?
So I think, you know, listening to you, Alicia, coming back from China, I hear what you say that The relationship is very difficult, and this is also what my Chinese interlocutors are telling me. And of course, all the measures that the EU is threatening or announcing, and some of them have been real. I mean, for example, you know, against the Temu and JD.com. I mean, you know, the EU has taken measures and flexing its economic policy. And I feel we need to be tougher, and the European economy will suffer. And I was talking about workers, but I think maybe consumers also will suffer, because at the end of the day, you know, these electric vehicles, they are targeting European consumers. But on the long run, you know, I think China needs to understand that, you know, with the US China rivalry becoming tougher and tougher, it cannot close the door to EU after all. You know, the EU market remains critical to China's economy. And as Alicia knows better than anyone, China's economy is not in the best shape. And there are a number of issues on the long run, including the demographic issue, that makes China actually much weaker than what may think. Therefore, I think the next couple of years, and especially, you know, as we have a number of political deadlines in Europe, including elections, government changes over the next 12 months, and also a tough transatlantic dialogue on many things, including on how to deal with China. This is not going to be an easy time, but I feel in the medium term, when things recompose or regroup, we may be a year from now in a better position to discuss with China. And meanwhile, China is not really helping its own image and its standing in the world when you think about the impact it may have on third parties, including in the global south, including in parts of the world where people also feel unsettled by the threats and by the economic security issues. I'm thinking in particular of Southeast Asia, but there are other parts of the world as well.
Thank you for that. Alicia?
Yeah, the final word comes to the question that the unanswered question from my side, who will suffer? I think it is very easy to say, everybody does say that our consumers will suffer if we are stricter on China's imports because of the lower price of, especially when we talk about green transition, EVs and so on. I think that's a very short-term calculation. Our consumers need to earn wages so that they can pay for their imports or their consumer goods. If they don't earn money, because they don't have a job, they can't buy either from China or anywhere else. Yeah, so it's very simple. If we have something better to do than autos, let's do it. But the reality is that the auto sector is 15 million jobs in Europe. So while we find something better to do and we become more competitive, we obviously have to protect our industry. And for a very simple reason, is because everybody else is doing this. We like it or not, that's how where the world is heading. So we cannot be the only economic bloc in the world that doesn't protect its market, because we simply can't change the world. It's not because this is the first best, it's because there's no other best. We're not big enough to change the trend, and this is the trend. So on that note, I think all of these comments on how much our consumers will lose are, again, short-sighted, and we need to think about what they will lose if they lose their jobs. Thank you.
Well, we ended on a somber note here. Thank you both for joining for this conversation. I am Vivian Jan, and I'm with Alicia Garcia-Herrero of Bruegel and Philip Lecoq of Asia Society and ASEC Business School. For listeners, you can find all our research on China on the IAA, the Industrial Accelerator Act, at bruegel.org. And sign up for Zhonghua Mundus, our monthly China podcast and newsletter, with link in the show notes. Until next time, bye-bye.